Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all over this great big world, including the people listening in Maharashtra, India. How about that? Welcome back to Deliver It. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast, episode 142. My name is Corey Bryan, and I am ready for change. That's right. Looking to change up lots of stuff, really, and digging it. So making plans for changes, implementing some small changes, looking for some bigger changes, and trying something different, because what I'm doing, some of it ain't working. So gotta try something else. So solo show today, a couple of things that I read in the last 2 weeks that I think you all to take a look at. The first one was an article from Marty Kagan and John Moore. It has a really good, interesting take on transformation defined. I saw a tweet from Tim Ottinger a little bit ago, who was talking about agile assessments and how he doesn't like them and what should we use instead, and there's levels and blah, blah, blah. Really good Twitter thread. You want to go look at what he says. What Marty and John are talking about is, what does transformation really mean? What actually changes? What is different? I like the two. They say three things, but I boil it down to two. Differences, that means that you have transformed the way that you work into more of an agile product, digital, whatever you want to call it. The first is the way that you build and deploy has changed. In that, they say, and I agree, that at a minimum, you should be building and deploying, putting things in customers' hands every 2 weeks. That fits nicely with what most people think of as a two-week sprint. The difference is that you actually get product into their hands. You don't just get done with work. You actually push code to production that people use in their daily interactions with your product. And you do that at a minimum of every 2 weeks. And if you're not doing that at a minimum for every 2 weeks, then you really haven't transformed much. Maybe you've gotten better. Maybe you've gone from 6 months to 3 months. That's better, sure. A transformed organization probably does that every 2 weeks at a minimum. And the second and third thing that I combined is the way that you select and solve problems has changed. So no longer is this somebody else telling the team what to do, how to do it. It's the team deciding that. So who does this? What problems do they select? How do they select them? How do they solve them? The team is really focused on doing that with you, the product person, as well. So if you want to know if you're in... If you want to know if your organization has transformed differently, or if they're going to transform, what does that mean? It means really those two things. What you pick and how it's solved changes, and how often you build and deploy into customers' hands has changed. Implementing Jira and doing sprints and doing stand-ups is not a transformation. So I really like that article, and it's really something that I think talks to assessments and different levels of, are we really agile? Have we gone through a digital or an agile transformation? What is different now? And I think those are two key things that are different. The second article is from Rich Mironov, who has Product Waste and the ROI of Discovery. Good lengthy article from Rich, and talks about a couple different things. One is product waste, something I've mentioned on before. We talk about technical debt. We talk about all those things. Product waste, building the wrong thing, products that are released on time, on budget, that don't deliver positive business outcomes. He has a whole list of other things that fall into the category of product waste, and I like them all, but I like that notion of, we're building the wrong thing, or we built the wrong thing, and that was a waste of a lot of different capabilities. I like his first step also. First step, he says, is to look back a few quarters. I would suggest a year. List everything that we built above a reasonable size. So let's say your epics or your capabilities, your big features, and do an intellectually honest scan for product waste. So of those things that your product released in the last year, which ones moved the needles that they were trying to? Which ones failed? Which ones succeeded? Which ones didn't do quite as well as you hoped? Let's say that you released 30 things. Were 10 of them successful? Were 5 of them waste? Were 20 of them okay? And definition of okay he gives as an ROI is reasonable expectation. And to that, he defines, let's say we did a $50,000 investment into this capability, this feature, whatever, we should be able to get back 4 to 5 times that, between 200 and 300,000 in return for that 50,000 investment. If you don't do that, then you're not really getting a good ROI. So I like that concept. I like the numbers that he tosses around as a gauge to say, is this right? Is this wrong? But I really like the notion of, okay, the things that we built in the last year, which ones were successful, which ones weren't. If you're doing good, you're probably in that 35 to 50% range. If you're doing bad, you're over that. So imagine 70 to 80% of the things that you built in the last year didn't move any needles, were effectively product waste. You didn't return your investment on it. And putting that in terms of money, which is one of the things Rich talks about in this article, is how you can talk to stakeholders, executives, and other folks about whether or not you should be doing those types of things. So, really good articles from Marty and Rich. As always, I always encourage you to read everything they write, but those two things really stood out for me.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
So I've done a few episodes about common problems that I see in adoptions, transformations, or however you like to call working in a more agile way. These are system or organization-wide issues that show up that you, the product owner, will come face-to-face with. The two big ones that I see are flow, that I've referenced a lot, and specifically in episode 61, and impediments in episode 107. There's a third common issue that happens an awful lot, and it's one of the hardest to change in my experience, and that is the system of incentives. This applies in three areas: the people in your organization, customers using your product, and to you, yourself. To start with, though, I found that if there's an issue with someone on the team or in the organization behaving in a strange or unhelpful manner I'm trying to work with, and I can't understand why this behavior is the way it is, it usually has something to do with their incentives. How are they rewarded or recognized? How are they punished? Well, not punished exactly, but how are rewards withheld from them so that it feels like a punishment? I've been in arguments about bug counts or story points or some other seemingly non-important number that I could not understand until I sat down with a person and they said, offhand of course, that they had to do this strange behavior because that's how they would advance their career, either in their goal or got their bonus. It's how they were incentivized. Most of those incentives were numerical and applied to only their individual accomplishments. Frequently you see this with salespeople trying to hit their numbers for the month, selling something weird that they then push to the engineering team that doesn't help the product, only their sales numbers. Sometimes this shows up as engineering managers requiring 10% more velocity. So individual developers work on their stories alone and increase their own velocity. I've had to change many different employee and contractor goals that were essentially committing and delivering to a number. Really, really bad. So most people, and more importantly, their behavior, are driven by some kind of incentive. Not exactly earth-shattering information, even though we forget that idea sometimes. Either intrinsic ones, how they see themselves, what they want to accomplish for themselves, or extrinsic ones, how are they rewarded, incentivized, or recognized by others. If it's extrinsic ones, then the way I found some success is by changing those goals and incentive. Instead of an individual producing 10% more per sprint, talk with the manager and change it to a team-based goal. Maybe it's finding a way to help the team reduce the time for a build or increase the frequency of deployments. I've seen incentives for senior team members change from do a percentage of code reviews to mentoring other team members or areas of the system they were experts in. This rewarded the team, and that's where the biggest change is. Alter the incentives and rewards to team-based ones instead of a single person. Now they are recognized as a contributor to a better and more effective team. That team is able to do more, and they helped. If someone really doesn't like that, if they really want to stand above the team, be recognized for their success, then hopefully they will leave that team and that organization. Not everyone works well in an agile environment, and that's okay. Hopefully they can find a good place for them. If the team and the organization's goal is to deliver value sooner to the customer for a competitive business advantage, then you have to have people that aren't compatible with that way of working leave. I've seen plenty of people adapt and change successfully, and a larger number than I'd like have left. That's the best case. The worst case is if they stay and their incentives stay focused on them. That's an impediment and it needs to be addressed. I've talked, worked with, and tried to reason with them, and it didn't matter. If the incentive, the reward, or the goal are not aligned to what you're trying to do, you won't get very far. Imagine a scenario where every team member has different incentives. Not only one, but multiple. Each person has five objectives they have to hit for their annual review. Each person has 3 to 5 individual ones that are different than the others on the team. How many different directions are the team heading in now? How hard is it to get them to work together for any length of time, to help each other, to collaborate? Even if you can get the team to work under the same incentive structure, what about the rest of the company? If the marketing person is rewarded for pushing campaigns and doesn't want to wait until product is ready, if the support person is rewarded for how quickly they close tickets, if the designers are incentivized to have positive feedback only from established customers, what kind of result will you get? How many different ways are teams, departments, and areas pulling away from a common goal? What if all those teams shared the same company goals, rewards, and incentives? That's one reason why I like to see more OKR-type frameworks used correctly, because it sets the system of your organization to focus on the same thing. Are the people you work with, or do you yourself, work well in an agile system that ignores incentives? I've worked with some, and I aspire to be myself, someone who does the right thing for the right reason, regardless of the external incentives. It's a carrot and a stick problem. You might be rewarded for certain behaviors and punished for others. I'm much more focused on my behaviors, beliefs, and motivations. What am I trying to get out of this effort? And what would happen for me to feel successful? Other times, it's helping others learn something they didn't know before. It's to learn a new skill or see them be successful in their noble goals. More than once, I've discussed Plato's allegory of the cave with someone. The notion that a person or a group of people could realize the world they were in and watching was a lie. That they could learn to see the light. In my terms, it means they could improve, and I could use my knowledge to help them. That's one of the main reasons for doing the show, to help others improve, to help you learn some things I know, and to explore some that I don't. What are your incentives for doing things? Is it to be right? Is it to get enough money for a new car? Is it to see others be successful? Do you understand why you're doing what you're doing, either because of external factors or in spite of them? If you don't understand why, then it's worth taking time to figure it out, both for the larger purpose and the small-scale efforts you're working on. I like the notion of working towards personal 5-year goals, then break it down into quarterly, weekly, and daily ones as well. That's different levels that are stacked together. They should all fit and align with a purpose. Customer incentives are interesting too. The question of why are they using this product or why are they trying to do this action is something that I come back to often to understand their true motives. The asking of why is needed gets a bad rap sometimes when you become a version of a 3-year-old that won't stop asking the question. Digging to their motivation for their selecting and choosing your product and activity in it is a crucial thing to understand. I've worked with internal products that some of the stories, requests, and frequent interactions didn't make much sense to me. They were focused on doing one specific task that I couldn't connect to the larger purpose of the product and its use. When I sat down with them to watch them work, to watch them use the product, that's when it would come out. They had to do it this way. Or update this field because that's what ended up on a daily or weekly report. That's what went to their boss, and that's what they were rewarded for in their annual performance review. How many times they performed a task, or with what percentage of success. How long someone was left on hold, how many repeat calls there were, how long they were on a call, how long a certain activity was open. Very similar to how many JIRA tickets they opened or closed in a day, week, or a month. Sound familiar? I wish I was joking. So again, the way the customer or user was being incentivized in using your product matters, and what they were incentivized for is the wrong thing as well. They don't need to enter or update 100 clients a day. They need to make sure the information is correct. They shouldn't need to adjust 50 tickets a day. They should reduce the need to have so many tickets in the first place. As a product owner, I want to understand their incentives. What are they really trying to do? Why is that important? I've worked on ways to solve the larger problem that were not successful because even though we solved it, it wasn't successful because the way the person was measured didn't change. So we made them more efficient at their job. And by the archaic ways they were rewarded, it looked like they were doing less than before. That situation really sucks. And I had to advocate both for the product changes we needed to make and for changing how the people who used it were evaluated. Their incentives needed to change. For other products, the user incentive may be purely intrinsic. It's one of the reasons I like asking people why they love certain products. What does it do for them? Who does it let them become? How do they feel after or while using it? I've mentioned my love for Waze before because it helps me avoid traffic, gives me a more accurate estimate of when I will arrive somewhere, and solves my unknown information problem. Those needs are my intrinsic motivation. I want to know more things than I currently do. I want to avoid waste and have a smooth, planned drive. My incentive is to arrive on time with less stress. Some people use that same product for other reasons. They don't know directions, or maybe they're trying to save on gas, whatever it takes. Explore their reason, build a story, and expand their world. So if you're in a situation or place where you can't understand something or someone, look at their incentives. The culture you're in plays such an important role in what's happening. Examine how the organization or individuals reinforce their incentives. Are they helping the team, the customers, or themselves? As a product owner, you may not have the direct opportunity to change them. You can have the conversation with those who can. Talk to them about why changing those incentives is important. You may need to talk with managers, HR, your boss, or leaders in other departments or companies. If you are not successful in changing anyone's incentives, at least you will understand them a little bit better. And then you can decide how those align or if they align with yours and act accordingly. I'll close with this quote from Charles Munger. You do not want to be in a pervasive incentive system that's causing you to behave more and more foolishly or worse and worse. Incentives are too powerful a control over human cognition or human behavior. Thank you for writing in and supporting the show. If you have a question about product ownership or anything else, you can find the show on Twitter at DeliverCast or email us at DeliverCast@gmail.com. If you would like to support the show, you can buy me a coffee through the links in the description or set up some consulting time at SeekTaiju.com. A couple questions that I saw this week. First one is from Walton. It says, what happens to your product at the end of the roadmap? It says, I'm a PO for a risk management app in a bank. We have built the app from ground up and our users are using it pretty happily. The sponsoring business have also said their needs are fulfilled and they have no time or money or appetite for further big changes to the app. And further change is not necessary. My question is, in your organization, what happens to the product once further roadmap is not required? Do you continue to look after it or hand it over to some other team? Interesting question, Walton. In every product, it's going to end at some point, either by choice. Either you choose to end the product or the market or customers choose to end the product's life. What happens after that? You can talk about that. I encourage you to think about that at any point during your product. How do we sunset this? How do we transition it? What do we do? What's the long-term prospects of this product? If the product is pretty stable and if there's no desire, you said there was no desire in time or money, for further changes, then yeah, you're probably going to sunset the product or at least hand it off to a maintenance mode. And that's it. That's kind of the end of life cycle for the product. And at some point, that product's going to need to be turned off. So who does all that stuff? It could be your team. It could be the team that you're with. Could continue working on that. It could be handed over to another team to just hold in maintenance while your team tackles bigger problems, more important problems than that one. Sure. I've done it both ways. We've both held on to a product until we decided to turn it off. It was low. It's maybe 2 to 5% per year budget-wise that we spent time on it. Just make sure the servers were reset or data quality issues or anything like that, but we didn't do any features or any capabilities to it. And I've also turned it over to a different group, an offshore group or something like that. That was just tasked with operations. That's all they did. They just made sure it was up. They didn't make any changes to it. But the cost of operating the application went to them and the support of it. So I've seen it both ways. It's important to think through and see what you actually want to do, though, for that. Allie had a question about customer advisory boards. Says, I've been given the task of forming a customer advisory board for my product, but I'm not sure where to begin. Could you please share your experiences? Customer advisory board. Okay. First thing would be to make sure you have a good variety of opinions on it. First thing I think would be keep it small or keep it small-ish. Probably maybe one or two groups of 5 to 10 people, 10 people max between the two groups if you do two groups. But I would keep it small. I would have a diverse set of opinions and product experience. So if you're a enterprise company, let's say you have two or three enterprise clients, two or three mid-sized clients, two or three small clients, and then one person who uses it differently. That's kind of what I would put together is what's a good representative sample of our users. I would want to get people on that customer advisory board who were willing to talk. Who didn't have to drag to that CAB meeting for discussions, who were interested in talking, who were interested in trying things out, who were giving you good feedback, who were giving you timely feedback, and were really invested in the success of your product. I think those are some key things that I would look for. And if somebody's not participating or if they don't want to participate, find somebody else. Where to go to find those people? I think the people that have good opinions of your product, that get good feedback, that have been customers for a while. Again, maybe you take, of those three enterprise clients, maybe one has been there for 10 years, one has been there for five, and one has been there for 1 year. So you get a good variety of ideas and opinions. So hope that helps, but I would look and make sure you keep it small, keep it to a good working session, and then talk to them often. And a question from Molly says, I'm facing hell. The head of product in my org has never been a PM, but an engineer that builds projects for businesses as a hustle. He hasn't built and maintained a product from zero to one. I'm a budding PM that knows how things are to be done, but I need guidance on how to do it properly. The pay is good here, but I'm so tired of him asking me to write requirement documents every time. What do you think I should do? Well, my experience in a very similar situation was that I left. Eventually, I tried to make some changes. I had a leader who did not understand the product as well. And I tried for a little bit. It was obvious that it wasn't going to change. So I changed. I changed organizations. I changed roles. And I left. So sometimes you can try to do the right things. Sometimes you're not able to do the right things. So you can either accept your fate, beat your head against the wall, or you can leave. So those are usually the three choices that you can see. But it's not a good situation, to be sure. How people get to some of the levels where they don't understand the skills needed or what the job is, I don't understand. But that's far beyond my pay grade. But it does happen. So sorry, Molly. I wish I could help you. And that will do it for this episode. I hope you have a great day. Thank you all so much for listening. All the opinions expressed here are mine. Find more of them at Corey Bryan on Twitter. That is episode 142 delivered. Go out and own the outcome.
Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.